All opinions expressed in the Food for Thought podcast series are those of the invited faculty. This content should not be taken as medical advice and is for informational purposes only. Please consult your regional clinical practice guidelines for clinical practice recommendations in your area.
Hello, and welcome to the Food for Thought food allergy podcast from Med Authority. In this series of podcasts, we are joined by world-leading experts discussing the challenges in diagnosis and management of food allergies. Now, over to our experts.
I'm Sharon Chinthraja, joining you all today from the Sean and Parker Center, Center for Allergy and Asthma Research at Stanford University. And I have the pleasure of two esteemed colleagues joining as well today. Professor Hugh Sampson, who is the professor of pediatrics at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, and the director emeritus of the Jaffe Food Allergy Institute and former PI of the Consortium of Food Allergy Research, as well as Dr. Alexandra Santos, an associate professor at King's College London, an honorary consultant in pediatric allergy at the Evelina London Children's Hospital. Welcome to you both today.
Thanks, Sharon.
Today, I have the privilege of discussing the topic of epitope testing and basophil activation test, going beyond food challenge testing with two experts in the field. So I'm very excited to talk about this today with both of you. Why don't we start out with trying to understand why the accurate diagnosis of food allergy is so important. Dr. Sampson, could you start us off, please?
Sure, Sharon. Thank you. Well, from the time I started in food allergy, the prevalence of has increased dramatically. And at least in the U.S. now, we're looking at something like 8% of the pediatric population and possibly 10% of the adult population based on the work from Northwestern. So it's obviously critical that we get the diagnoses right, given the numbers of patients that we're dealing with. It's important to get it correct in somebody who is reactive because you want to be able to make sure they're not going to go out and have an accidental ingestion, which could in fact lead to severe reactions such as anaphylaxis. But on the other hand, you also want to make sure you don't overdiagnose because it can have significant effects on their nutritional status and certainly a major effect on their quality of life.
Yes, I agree. The accuracy of diagnosis is so important because the positive or negative outcomes of that have long-lasting effects for the patient and the family. Alexandra, Dr. Santos, can you walk us through how food allergy is currently diagnosed?
Sure. So when we suspect of food allergy, the first step is to take a detailed allergy-focused clinical history. So that's really the key element to reach an accurate diagnosis. A detailed clinical history and clear communication with the family or the patient allows us to establish whether there's been a history of reaction or there's actually a history of uneventful consumption, in which case there's no concerns about food allergy, or whether they have been eating the food in an age-appropriate amount or whether they have been avoiding the food for some reason. And then there's other elements that we need to collect as part of any clinical history. And then the next step is to find, look for evidence of IgE sensitization to that specific food. And we can do that using skin prick testing or using, for example, specific IgE in the serum. So that's a blood test where we look for, well, we measure the IgE antibodies to a specific allergen in the blood. And so, and then we try to make a diagnosis based on a combination of these two pieces of information. So the clinical history and the presence of IgE sensitization. So if there's a clear history and IgE is positive, we can confirm the diagnosis and often we don't need to do any more tests. If there's a history of any uneventful consumption, then we don't need to do any more tests. If there is no history of consumption and there's no sensitization, it's probably safe to start eating the food. Anything in between, so where there's a discrepancy between the history or IgE sensitization, or when the history is not entirely clear, or there's no history of exposure to the food and their resensitization. So these are all equivocal scenarios where we then need to do more tests. And the gold standard, so the best test we have at the moment, is the oral food challenge. The ideal sort of real gold standard is the double-blind placebo-controlled food challenges. In clinical practice, open challenges are often sufficient. And essentially, they consist in bringing the patient into the hospital or the office of the practicing clinician and start with small amounts of the food and then build this up over time at set intervals under close observation until reaching an age-appropriate portion of the food. And if there's no reaction, then the challenge is negative. The patient can introduce the food in the diet. If there is any signs of symptoms or signs of an allergic reaction during this process, and there's specific criteria to establish whether a challenge is positive or negative, then we can consider a challenge positive if there's any signs or symptoms of an allergic reaction, in which case the patient is diagnosed with food allergy and advised usually to avoid the food or undergo a specific treatment.
Yeah, great. If I could just jump in, I mean, one of the nice things is that many of these foods are outgrown. So things like milk and egg and wheat and soy, the patient will oftentimes outgrow. So if we have a distant history, so when they were very young, say they reacted to milk, but now we're looking at them at 5 or 6, there is a good chance that they've outgrown it. And there, you know, as Alexandra said, that it's important to get the recent history. But then also when we look at the skin tests, for example, one of the things I tell my patients, the larger the wheel size on that skin test, the more likely it is that they're going to be reactive. Doesn't talk about severity, doesn't talk about the dose that'll, you know, activate the reaction, but it does give us an idea of if, whether or not it's likely. And then, you know, as Alexandra said, we go on and look at blood tests. And again, they're the same kind of scenario. The higher that level, the more likely it is that they're going to react. And then with some foods, some of the component proteins are useful. You know, so for example, we have a very high number, high prevalence of birch pollen allergy in our area. And as many people know, BETV1, the major allergenic protein in birch pollen, cross-reacts with lots of fruits and vegetables, but also things like hazelnut, and we also see it cross-react with peanut. So again, sometimes those components will make, you know, we'll find that somebody who has a level, say to peanut, that's actually exceeds what we would think they would have to be reactive, we find out it's mostly due to the ARA-H8, which is the BETV1 cross-reacting protein, and those people oftentimes can eat it. So there's a little bit of examination there, but you know, or a gray area, and that's where sometimes we have to do, as Alexandra said, we have to go on to the oral food challenge.
Yes, and the decreasing levels, conversely to the fact that a higher level is associated with a more likely, you know, higher likelihood of reacting, then a decreasing level of IgE over time gives us also a hint, together with, you know, no recent history of a reaction, that the child may be resolving. And this is when we do a challenge to assess for possible resolution. Yeah.
Yeah, great point. So not only is it a one-time testing or seeing of the patient and family, but it's actually following them and tracking them over time and tracking these tests over time and using the food challenge not only to diagnose a positive food allergy, but also to understand a resolution of a food allergy. I think these are huge, huge points. We know that the food challenge is the gold standard in these equivocal areas, as Alex mentioned. What are the limitations for food challenges? Hugh, could you?
Yeah, well, being a big proponent of food challenges, I have the food challenge. It gives us the definitive answer, but there certainly are negatives to it. It's very time consuming. It's resource intense. It's expensive. It's not fun for a patient to go through a challenge. Oftentimes creates a lot of anxiety, both in the patient or if it's a child, in the parent and the child. And then we also run the risk that somebody's going to experience a severe anaphylactic reaction. So if we had a test that could really step in and replace the food challenge, I think everybody that works with food allergy would be much happier.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with that. I think that, you know, when we investigate for possible food allergy, we need to be prepared to do food challenges. And I think that's also an important message, is that when we, you know, start by taking a history and looking for evidence of IgE, we need to be able to offer a challenge, because in all those equivocal scenarios, we need to have a definitive answer. And that is provided by the challenge. And the challenge can also have other, you know, important roles apart from diagnosis. Actually, it can also, you know, sort of give reassurance to the family, be a good educational opportunity, and so on. But it does, as you very well said, it does have, you know, imply a risk of an allergic reaction, and all the time and resources implied. But I think we need to be prepared to do food challenges when we assess a patient for possible food allergy, but trying to make the most of all the other tests and all the other tools we have to try to minimize the patients we have to put through that.
Yeah, no, I totally agree.
And I think all of us here, we do a lot of food challenges in the research setting and in the clinical setting. And it is time intensive from the provider perspective, the amount of resources that have to go into that, and making sure that we have appropriate resources to treat anaphylaxis. And then families, you know, sometimes at our center, we have patients coming from long distances. We've had weather, travel emergencies, et cetera, you know, the pandemic, which makes getting to the office for this test challenging, to say the least, not only for patients, but for the whole team involved. So in your minds, what are the ideal tests, ideal characteristics for a diagnostic test for food allergy? Alex?
Well, so I think in general terms, I think ideally it should be sort of non-invasive to be comfortable for patients to go through. I think it needs to be, you know, technically feasible and analytically validated, meaning that it is, you know, reproducible, consistent, sort of a robust test that you can actually reproduce in different settings, in different places, for different patients. And then importantly, it needs to be clinically validated. So we need to really compare the results of this test with outcomes of food challenges, so which is the gold standard, to understand how this test performs and what are the results that are associated with a higher likelihood of allergy, and what are the results that allow us to completely exclude food allergy, and what are all the in-between results where probably we need to do a food challenge still. But so it's important to clinically validate. I think that we have to, and I'm very sort of passionate about this, I think it's very important to have, you know, robust tests that are accurate. But I think even the perfect test, I think we have to be very, very aware and conscious of the fact that no test gives you the absolute answer ever. And I think whatever result we get, we always have to put this in the clinical context of the patient we have in front of us. And we also need to be very careful when extrapolating the results of published studies or how a test performs to see if it's actually applicable to our clinical setting and the patient population that we see. And always, and sometimes also, like, the way when we look at studies, it's the performance of the test in the population. So we'll always find the odd patient that falls out of the, you know, it's the 1% or the 5%. So we cannot really rely completely on any type of test. So it's always putting this in the clinical context and interpreting the test and making the clinical decision in the clinic room with the patient we have in front of us, and not really just you apply, you know, percentages of positive predictive value or sensitive specificity, because that's not, you know, that's just the performance of the test. But I think thinking about the test itself, I think being non-invasive, you know, technically feasible and analytically validated, and then clinically validated, ideally in more than one patient population, and a patient population that is relevant to the patients we see in clinical practice, would probably make the ideal test.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100% agree.
Yeah.
Something that's wonderful to know.
Something that's widely available for all of our patients, rural, urban, and applicable, I think, across the globe. You know, so that we're all on the same page. Yeah, no, I agree. Hugh, what alternative diagnostic tests are currently under development? I know you've been thinking about this and doing a lot of work in this area for a long time, both of you actually, but love to hear your thoughts, Hugh.
Okay, well, I think the two that are probably closest to the clinic are going to be one that we've been focusing on, the what we call the bead-based epitope assay, and then one that Alex has been focusing on, which is the base fell histamine activation test. So I'll let her talk about that because she's put a lot of effort into that. I'll talk about the epitope analysis. So a number of years ago, we had the idea that if we actually look to see exactly where IgE bound on these specific proteins, we might be able to get more information and a more accurate diagnosis. And that sort of comes from the fact that we've seen with, if I'll speak about peanut because that's the one that's now available. But if we do a blood test of peanut, we get the total IgE, as we were talking about before, you may get IgE to a different component protein that's really not related to systemic reactivity. And so taking it to the next step where you're now not only looking at a component protein, but you're actually looking at where on that the major allergenic proteins, the IgE is binding, you might get more accurate information. And just to make a long story short, that seems to be the case. In with peanut, we started out by looking at in RH1, 2, and 3 at about 90 different epitopes. And we've been able to narrow that down and find that really two epitopes will give us, if we look at two epitopes and whether people bind to that, we can get a diagnostic accuracy of over 90%, depending on the population. You know, as Alex was saying, it matters what population you're talking about. But with this, we see 90 to 95% accuracy in that diagnosis. And then the other thing that we were looking at was whether or not we could get information about how much protein we'd expect this person to be able to tolerate before they would react. And again, looking at a specific epitope analysis using machine learning and various algorithms, we were able to come up with basically three buckets: people who react to very low dose, people who react to moderate dose, and people who could actually tolerate a higher dose. And just to give an idea, for example, with the low dose group, we know that less than 10% of the people that fall in that bucket would ever be able to consume like a 300 milligram challenge without having a reaction. But if you move to the other end of the spectrum and, you know, bucket three or the high dose group, we find that about 75% of those patients can actually tolerate, you know, a 300 milligram dose or a cumulative dose even of over 400 milligrams. This can make a huge difference in somebody's lifestyle, you know, if you, and also in our decisions on whether or not to do immunotherapy. If you're in that low dose group, you probably do want to do something, you know, to try to get yourself in a better situation, whereas in the higher dose group, it may not be quite so critical. So we think that that will be useful. This test is now available in the US. It's not available, you know, in Europe yet, but it is something that we're also looking at with milk and egg, and we're going to look at other tree nuts and things. So hopefully, you know, they take a while, you know, to go all through what Alex was talking about, all this validation, you know, takes time. And hopefully these are going to be some of the next steps that we see, and it eliminates a lot of the food challenges that we have to do.
Yeah, that's really exciting. I think it's exciting to see the recent developments and the fact that it's actually available. I mean, as Hugh mentioned, there's also the cellular test, so namely the basal cell activation test, which where we use patients' whole blood and look at the cells involved in allergic reactions and see by flow cytometry whether they react or not. So essentially, we take a small sample of blood, and then we divide in different aliquots, and then we add different amounts of allergen, and then also negative and positive controls. And then we add antibodies that allow us to identify the basophil population. And then within this basophil population inside the blood, we look at whether the activation markers are expressed on the surface of these cells or not. So these activation markers are expressed when the cells degranulate and release histamine and other mediators, which is what happens during an allergic reaction. So it's a functional test. So it contains the cells involved in allergic reactions, the IgE antibodies and the allergen, and we see whether that sort of reaction happens or not. So we've developed this, and others as well have worked on this assay. We started by looking at how this test performed for peanut allergy. So we have assessed the utility of this test in a large cohort of children being assessed for possible peanut allergy. And then we've seen that the test was very accurate to and reflected the patient's phenotype with about 97% accuracy. So in the initial sort of development and discovery cohort, the test had a 98% sensitivity and 96% specificity. And then we were able to validate this in an independent cohort, prospectively recruited after we had determined the optimal cutoff. And the specificity was 100%. The sensitivity was 83%, so that's lower, but it's actually the higher specificity that is the greatest addition to the tests we already have, like skin prick tests and specific IgE to extracts, which we have in routine clinical practice. And so we then have validated it even further in a very large population of participants recruited into the LEAP study and associated studies. And the performance of the test, so we used exactly the same protocol and applied the cutoff that we had previously defined. And again, the specificity was 99%. So again, supporting the use of this test to confirm the presence of peanut allergy. We are currently analyzing data for other foods like egg, milk, sesame, and cashew nut. And so far, the results are very exciting. I mean, as Hugh mentioned, it takes a long time. And I think the cellular tests are a little bit behind the epitope in terms of the development phase. But I think I'm really hoping that this could be available in clinical practice and widely available to many clinicians worldwide in the future, but let's watch this space.
No, I think that this is exciting progress. I think this is something that the food allergy community has been waiting for. Other more accurate testing that can aid in diagnosis and the long-term management of food allergy. What do you think about using these tests in clinical practice? When will it be available? What do you envision the future to look like with many of these newer tests available to clinicians, and how do you see it coming to clinical practice, not only in research communities, but in lay practice? I'd love your thoughts on that. Hugh.
Okay. Well, as far as there is this test out there called VeriMap, which is available for, people in clinical practice to order. My take on it would be is there are cases where we get the history and some of our routine tests aren't as accurate as we'd like. And this test is quite accurate. So it certainly can give you a pretty good yes or no answer. The follow-up to that is if it is yes, then it is able to put your patient into one of those three categories. The child that's going to react at very low dose, or those in the high, moderate or higher dose range. And I think, like I said, I think for me in the practice I have, that's very useful in counseling the patient and the parents about what they can expect. Other foods, it is going to take, probably another, I would say at least probably a year to 2 years before we see some of the other ones coming out. But we are working with a company that's commercializing that and trying to get those out. And so right now the focus is on milk, egg, and then some of the tree nuts, as well as sesame. And then we also have been looking at wheat and hope to have something that'll be much more accurate, because I don't know, Alex, and your experience, but our experience with skin tests and blood tests to wheat are not very good. If we could have a much more accurate one there, it would be really helpful.
Totally agree. Wheat is a very challenging one. the sensitivity and specificity of both skin test and specific IgE are not very good. It's very challenging to diagnose. And sesame is another one, although with a different sort of behavior, let's say, with a different pattern. But it's also a very challenging one, and it can cause a quite severe reaction. So that's another one. I mean, with the basophil activation test, I think it is, I would see it, you know, once it becomes available in clinical practice, I would see it more as a second step, especially with the current setup where it's a relatively manual assay. So I would do it in selected patients where we cannot get a definitive answer with the history and the tests we already have, like skin test to extract specific IgE to extract specific IgE to components, or even the epitope testing if we have that available. And then so for those patients where we would refer for a challenge, actually do the basophil activation test. If the basophil activation test is positive, we can confirm allergy and with a high degree of confidence and recommend allergen avoidance or a specific treatment. If the test is not positive, then we would do a challenge, but the chances that this challenge is positive are much lower. So reducing the number of positive challenges and then also the number of challenges overall. If we are able to do it sort of this assay in an automated fashion and in a more cost-effective way, then we could think about testing in a more, sort of a larger scale. But I think at the moment, I see it as more of a second step in the diagnostic process, only for the patients that are equivocal after doing the diagnostic workup we currently have available in practice.
Yeah, I think that those are great points that both of you have made, that these tests have clear areas where they can be a tool in the allergist toolbox for aiding the diagnosis and management of the food allergic patient. And certainly as these tests broaden the impact beyond peanut and the ability to test multiple foods with one test or a series of tests for the multi-allergic individual, I think this will have huge impact. So grateful to both of you for the amazing work that you do and continue to do in this regard to make the diagnosis of food allergy much clearer and easier for our patients and for the food allergy community. So thank you both.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks, Sharon. Thank you.
MedThority would like to thank the faculty involved for that fascinating insight. If you have any questions regarding this podcast, please feel free to ask us via our website, www.medthority.com. Remember to tune in for the next episode of MedThority Podcasts. From all of us at MedThority, thank you for listening and have a lovely week.